This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Boston.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. Batter up! Baseball season is in full swing. Barry Bonds is hitting home runs like there's no tomorrow. But just what will tomorrow bring for baseball? In this hour, rounding the bases of baseball's rich past and uncertain future. But first, we begin tonight in Rome with a look ahead to next week's meetings between the Vatican and American cardinals about the sex abuse scandal roiling the church. Melinda Henneberger is Rome bureau chief for the New York Times. Earlier, I asked her to describe how the mood in Vatican City has changed from what it was just a few weeks ago.
At that time, I think the feeling in the Vatican still was that this was being exaggerated by Americans, that this was a uniquely American problem, and that this is really being pushed by the media who had an axe to grind with the Catholic Church, and that it was somehow an anti-Catholic story. Now, though, the Pope and other top officials at the Vatican really do understand, after having talked to American bishops last week about the problem, just how serious it is. And so they have called this very unusual meeting, putting all American cardinals on the plane in a matter of days to get them over here to talk about how to solve the problems.
And when the Vatican moves quickly, this is like a glacier getting up and sort of dog trotting, isn't it?
Yes, that's really the astonishing thing about it. I mean, to get anything done here in a matter of days. And they're going to have daily, maybe twice daily press briefings, which, needless to say, is not the way things are usually done here. And I think they really are trying to have an American type response to the problem now that they understand how severe the situation had become.
Well, you mentioned that they're going to even be talking about issues like celibacy, the screening of gay candidates for the priesthood, and the role of women. But are they going to be talking about them with a view to, debating them as actual issues or as a matter of a kind of public relations?
First of all, I don't think anyone should think that any policy is going to be changed in 2 days of meetings. I think that they are very serious about debating celibacy and debating gay candidates for the priesthood, but maybe not in the ways that a headline would suggest. I mean, I think what they want to talk about on celibacy, for example, is whether it's being taught correctly in seminaries. I don't think that they're opening up the question, although some in the United States, Roger Mahoney, the cardinal in Los Angeles, has said that he would like to open up the discussion for married priests. I think what folks in the Vatican are thinking when they talk about celibacy is, why are we not getting across what the celibate life means in a better way to our seminarians? Don't we need to think more about the roots of celibacy and how we can teach it better?
Not to be crude, but isn't this kind of a conservative take on what celibacy? In other words, we're not making it strict enough. We're not holding people to their... So it's kind of like we're going to talk about celibacy, but as a way of cracking down.
Well, I think that conservatives and liberals are now pulling out their wish lists and saying, great, this is the opportunity to push through what we wanted anyway. And yes, very much so. Conservatives in the church have for a long time been pushing for screening gay candidates for seminaries, for example. And that will very much be on the table. Then those from the liberal camp will be pushing for something that the Vatican has said for years is a closed issue, the ordination of women.
Several weeks ago, some friends of mine moved into Hanover, New Hampshire, and went to Mass on Sunday. And the priest began by saying, I'm angry. I'm furious. This crisis in the church is just intolerable. And behind it all, are the feminists. Do you hear that? Do you hear that kind of, is there a reactionary sort of background to any of this?
You know, to tell you the truth, I haven't. From people at the top, you certainly, and from officials in the United States, you certainly have heard a defensive posture. But something that has, that I've heard over and over again from sort of the rank and file priests at the Vatican is how angry they are on behalf of the victims. Mm. I have really not heard that sort of, you know, poor me, I'm embarrassed to wear a collar. I have really heard, you know, why aren't we cleaning house? Why aren't we standing up and taking responsibility? Although from the officials at the top, you certainly have heard, why aren't we looking at what the percentage is of pedophiliacs in the general population versus priesthood? But no, from guys who are not in position to make decisions, I haven't heard that.
Mm. And finally, what about the Pope himself? He's in pretty bad shape. Is he going to participate?
He is going to participate in at least some of the meetings. He is ill, but still mentally sharp, I think, and very much wants to hear and not only hear from the American cardinals, but I think really sort of guide the parameters for what the American bishops may come up with as possible solutions.
Has anyone told you about his reaction to all this?
You know, initially it was so difficult for us to understand why he hadn't reacted sooner. People kept telling me, you know, he really doesn't know the extent of the problem. Mm. And we can say, how could that possibly be? But he really has never involved himself too much in day-to-day operations at the Vatican. He has been ill. He was feeling in particular pain over the recent weeks. He's been very distracted by the problems in the Middle East.
Yes.
And I just think the people who might have told him about how bad it was were loath to deliver the bad news.
Melinda Henneberger is the Rome bureau chief for the New York Times. She spoke with us earlier today. The meetings between American cardinals and the Vatican begin on Tuesday. Baseball attendance is down more than 3% this year. Blame the economy, mediocre teams, or the talk about dissolving franchises and a possible work stoppage. But with all the antics and angst off the field, there are still moments of glory. The White Sox are surging. Jason Giambi is finding his groove in Yankee pinstripes. Early home run derby leaders include A-Rod, Sosa, Bonds. But can the greatest show on dirt survive its own bad public relations? Commissioner Bud Selig has cried poverty to Congress. Anger flickers between owners and players, and fans are caught in the middle between love of the game and disgust with the business of baseball. Is baseball still America's favorite pastime? What are your hopes for this season? Who are the players to watch and why? And if you were the king or queen of baseball, what would you change? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me from Locust Grove, Virginia, is Dave Kindred, columnist for the Sporting News and author of the new book, Glove Stories. Welcome, Dave Kindred.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's a pleasure having you with us. Start us off with a passage from your book, which I should say is a compilation of some of your columns from the Sporting News for the last 10 years.
10 years. Yes, sir.
Yep. Okay.
You know, as in all of these collections, they're dated, but in a hope to in an attempt at a timeless piece, I wrote a new prologue for the book in which I wrote about my mother. Mm-hmm. And it begins, "One day when the world was young, Mom came home with a typewriter for me. It was a clunky amalgamation of iron pieces that weighed a pound or two less than Dad's 48 Ford pickup. At our kitchen table, I rolled a piece of paper into the machine. Then, as I would do for the rest of the 20th century and into the 21st, I sat before the typewriter, not knowing what to write. I wanted the words to be memorable, my first typed words. Finally, I began pecking at the keyboard. Here's what came out: Stanley Frank Musial. All these years later, my mother, Marie, still works at that kitchen table in the house my father built. It's on First Street in the small central Illinois town of Atlanta. First Street runs alongside a raised railroad bed. On the other side of the railroad tracks are tar-patched remnants of U.S. Route 66. In the famous highway's glory days, we'd drive 3 hours north and be at Wrigley Field, 3 hours south,
Sportsman's Park at Stan Musial, like living in the middle of heaven. I was a baseball kid. I'm still a baseball kid, as I hope this collection of sporting news columns shows. From our house in Atlanta, it's 6 blocks to the town's ball diamond. I walk there now, out the shortstop, to remind myself how good it felt to be in a place where being in that place was all that mattered. A small world, the ball diamond, and I love it.
Very good. And when you write about baseball, you really catch something. I've seen Mark McGwire hit home runs, and you describe it. You write, the ball seems to separate itself from gravity, rising on a tail of fire. That's wonderful. Well, to turn from that poetry to grimmer matters, last year's World Series, I thought, was electrifying. And yet we read, I'm looking at a USA Today piece about falling of attendance of as much as 30% in some places, 20%, Tigers down 15%, all across baseball. Why didn't the bounce from last year carry over?
Well, I think, Jack, you mentioned it earlier, that baseball, in your intro, baseball's public relations is about as bad as you can be. If someone wanted to undermine baseball and destroy baseball and make baseball unpalatable, they could do no better than what Bud Selig did, the commissioner, 2 days after that World Series. One of the great World Series ever. You know, in my mind, both places won. New York City won. Mm. It was a great redemptive week for the city. Then in Arizona, a team that had never been to the World Series before wins it on the last at-bat. You can't be better than that.
Yeah.
And then 2 days later, Selig announces we're in desperate straits. We're going to contract. We're going to eliminate two teams, thereby beginning the ugly war of words with the players. That will continue all through this year.
Yeah, it is going to continue all through this year, and we want to get to that. But, you know, your columns remind me that at the start of this decade, we had small market teams like Minnesota and Toronto in the World Series. Kind of unthinkable now. What's happened since?
Well, I think it's all of the owners' public relations. The owners want you to believe that it's impossible for the small market teams to win. I mean, it was not... In 1991, Atlanta was a mid-market, at best, small-market team. You know, they since have become the best team in baseball. I think it is much harder now to operate with less revenue and still be good, but it's not impossible. The Oakland A's are a great example of that even now. Teams that spend their money wisely, spend it well, are still able to compete. Minnesota, even last year, was a competitor past the All-Star game. And I think it's all, you know, again, it's all smoke and mirrors. It all seems to me to be part of the owner's strategy to demean the players, to make the players look like spoiled brats. They've got too much money. You know, we have to quit this. When in effect, the New York Yankees have always had the most money.
Mm-hmm.
From the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. They've always been the richest team in baseball. There's no difference. It's just a matter of degree. And also a change in society. I guess baseball needs to acknowledge that. There is a difference. Now everyone thinks they deserve to win every year. Mm-hmm. It used to be that people were happy just going out to a game to be entertained.
Right.
Now this instant gratification kind of thing that America has become demands that we win, and we win right now.
Yeah.
We just keep winning forever.
Right. What's the status of the revenue-sharing notion, which would try to deal with this imbalance between markets by the richer, better-off teams sharing with the lesser-off?
Well, the sad story is that the owners have now come up with a plan that makes semi-sense to me, and the players don't want anything to do with it because it does put a drag on salaries, and the players want no drag on salaries.
Mm.
The owners are offering to split revenues in a meaningful way, up to 50%. The players only want to split them to 22%. There's room for negotiation there, and I think they will. They must negotiate that. But at the same time, you know, in the last 30 years, every time, 8 times, that the collective bargaining agreement has been negotiated, it's not been negotiated without a work stoppage. So we're in the 9th time. I fully expect a 9th work stoppage. I just hope that it's not long and not disastrous as the 94 stoppage was.
Yeah, let's hope. We're going to come right back, Dave. We're talking about baseball. Is it still America's pastime? Does earning money matter more than earned run averages? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
Joe's the big picker-upper. Gets a handful. Throws it away. Now walking up to the plate. Sort of relaxes. Leans over. Touches the heavy end down from the platter. Straightens up. Cocks that bat. Fitzsimmons works. DiMaggio swinging. It's a whistling line drive to left center field. It's a base hit. It's taken on the second hop by Ripple. The throw is coming in a second. DiMaggio's racing for it. DiMaggio makes it with a slide and is saved for a double.
That was the voice of Red Barber calling a Yankee game from 1937. We're talking baseball, taking the long view, our best memories of the better times of baseball. This hour with Dave Kindred, Sporting News, and author of a new collection of his pieces, Glove Stories. And you can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us, too, on the line now is Bill Lee. Bill Lee pitched, as no one in this town, that is Boston, needs to be reminded, pitched 14 years in the major leagues, 10 with the Red Sox and 4 with Montreal. His autobiography, The Wrong Stuff, gives a flavor of his tart and candid and provocative perspective. Welcome, Bill Lee.
Well, hello.
Hi. Just before the break, Dave Kindred was mentioning talking about the prospects. He thought they were pretty solid of a work stoppage this season. What do you think?
Well, I think that people are just fed up with pro sports in general. They just don't go to the ballparks that much, except for football, which is our society of aggression and manifest destiny, and we can push the Indians off the continent and do everything we want, and that's that. But baseball is, you know, pastoral, and we're getting away from that. Our farms are smaller. Our people are more into the X Games. I talked to a guy with about 15 rings in his head, and I said, you know, this guy walked into the store, and I said, that was Tony Oliva. And he goes, who's Tony Oliva? And it wasn't Tony Oliva, but he had a Twins hat on, and I said, you wouldn't know. That's a team sport. You're into individual sports. You just want to go out and kill yourself on any given Friday. And as far as a work stoppage goes, that's kind of, you know, it happens every 4 years. I mean, of course. I mean, 72, we had a short works walk out, and then in 76 they locked us out, and then in 81 we had a major one, and then in 94 they stopped the World Series, and it's the economics of baseball. No one just plays the game, and to hear Red Barber describe that base hit, as much as I hate the Yankees, it was poetry, and we don't get that anymore. We don't get the Vin Scully's big bouncer over the mound, over second base, up with his mantilla, throws low and wild, Hodges scores, we go to Chicago.
I know, that music.
Yeah, it's music, and work stoppage, that's modern music, Enron, defraud the people. You know, the stock market's going down. It's the biggest gamble in the house. I'm a fidelophile.
Fidelophile.
That's a fidelophile. That's a guy who goes to Cuba to look at true baseball.
Oh, really? They love it down there.
They play all the time, and they play on the streets, and little boys play with little gumballs of rosin that they make off of a pine tree up in the foothills of the Sierra Maestra, where Castro hung out for about 3 months, and Batista could never rout him out of there. And so I am, you know, as far as work stoppage, I could care.
You could care, yeah. Dave Kindred, that evocation of the kids playing in the streets in Cuba, was that what baseball used to be like in this country?
Yes, it was, and that's the baseball that I try to keep in mind. And it's, as Bill suggests, it becomes, if not impossible, all but impossible. And you know, the only reason that at my advanced age I'm still a sports writer is that I can still conjure up those memories, because when you go to the ballpark now, it's, you know, I much more enjoy, along the line of Bill's fidelophile, I much rather go to a minor league game.
Oh, really?
Where you're closer to the action, it's on a human scale.
Mm-hmm.
You know these guys are playing because they have a dream. Maybe their dream is to make $8 million a year.
Yeah.
but at least it looks like they're playing baseball because they love it, not because they're going to make $8 million a year. And that feels better to me. And if it's very hard to keep that feeling, but, you know, as a sports writer who has always loved baseball, I try to block out the rest of it and deal with it as little as I can and try to remember the romance and the sentimentality of it.
Sure. Do you feel that, though, from any active players now, guys who just love the game?
Well, just listening to Bill talk there reminded me of just hanging around him in dugouts, and that it was fun to just listen to him. The last guy that I talked to who I felt had a pure joy in baseball was Rex Hudler, who played in Philadelphia. Rex the Wonder Dog, he called himself. I mean, he played for I don't know, 15, 16 years with almost no talent. He was just what he called the fastest white guy you've ever seen. You know, he loved the game, and he would have played for nothing.
Bill, you wouldn't have played for nothing.
Well, I did.
I played
for $9,500. I made more money in the off season than I did. I was in the Army in Fort Polk, Louisiana, and then I went to Fort Devens and was a MP for a while I tried to sneak into Fenway Park and work out, but wasn't allowed to in the 70 season. And then I was 9-2 after I came out of there, and they bumped my salary up to about $13,000. You know, what does a 9-2 pitcher make nowadays after two years?
Yeah, that's Jim Bouton's line, is that the owners had their way for 125 years. The players have had their way now for 30 years, so they've still got 95 more to go.
Pro sport can't handle it. People, the fans, everything you've got, just it's still the greatest game in the world.
Yeah.
You know, when you get that beautiful game that's played in the day, and it's well played, well pitched, clutch hitting.
And who would have ever, you know, you've talked about the lack of imagination of managers for years, but who would ever have imagined that in the last game of the World Series, Randy Johnson would come into relief for Curt Schilling?
It was great.
I mean, that's the kind of thing, the bold move that just is.
Because he went to USC.
Ah, that's it.
He's a Trojan. We do that all the time. It's in our genes. There is no pain and fear when you go to USC, because you're living in a ghetto and you got to fight your way all the time down the streets and tough. It's a tough neighborhood, and it's a tough place to play. And I'll tell you, when I played there, it was that was something. When I went to the pros after college, it was a step in the wrong direction.
Let's take a call. Andy is on the line. Hello, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
Calling from Boston, listening to Lee, which is when I was a kid, probably the second half of his career. And I was thinking, you know, the game we played most in our backyard with my brother was diving catches. And that was because of Freddie Lynn and the way that he played the outfield.
Another Trojan.
Literally throw the ball.
Oh, another Trojan.
We would throw the ball. Yeah, we'd throw the ball far away from each other.
Huh.
And try to crash into the ground and imitate, you know, what he obviously only did, you know, out of desperation. And it just reminded me of growing up kind of with the same players over a period of time. I'm all for the players to be able to have mobility and negotiating power, but you wonder with kids nowadays if they have to pick new heroes every year, or on the other side, maybe they follow their stars around the league as they change teams.
From team to team, yeah.
Yeah, and then end up not having that same bond. Of course, I'd love to be free of that bond that I'm still afflicted with in the case of the Red Sox.
Yeah.
But,
well, that's a disease.
Yeah, but I hate to be too nostalgic at the same time, because you don't want to be in talking about the old days.
Sure.
But, you know, you can't help but wonder.
Yeah, that's a good question. What about that, Dave Kindred, the free agency and the bonding with players on a team? That kind of, the very mention of Fred Lynn, I mean, gosh, he left.
I think in a Seinfeld episode, he dealt with that, Jerry did, in which he said, nowadays we root for the laundry.
Yeah.
The players are gone, we just root for the laundry now. And there's something to be said for that. I think that loyalty has been diminished, you know, both by owners and players. There's no sense that anyone is in it for anything except to make the dollar. No one wants to be in Boston their whole career. You know, that era is over. And there is I missed that too. You know, Stan Musial played for the Cardinals his entire career. I met him late, you know, after he'd been long retired, and asked him, had free agency been in effect, would he have been a Cardinal his whole career? And he almost laughed at me, like, what are you talking about? Of course he'd have been gone. So it's a function of the times, and I miss it too. But at the same time, I think we all get an emotional investment in the city that we live. There's some kind of personal connection working there that baseball, for one, has long been able to use.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Bill Lee, what was it like playing in Boston, known for its rabid, passionate fans?
Well, it was tough. It was when I came up from Pittsfield, I drove into Boston, and I saw the big, the lights, the bank of lights, and the big green monster, and I took the first right down at the Prudential Center, and I took my next right coming back, and I thought the other direction, and I'd be at the ballpark. I ended up in Cambridge. then I saw the park again, and I never got there, and I realized that I was born after the Northwest Territories Act, and I lived in the West, and everything was north, south, east, west. Well, it was tough. I mean, but once I gave myself into that city and said, I'm going to be here, and I'm going to be here for a long time, and I'm going to be mayor, and then I'm going to be governor, and I'm going to run for president. And once I made that commitment, then the fans loved me, and I drank with all of them. I hung out with them. I played flag football. I did everything. And I spoke my mind, and they kind of embraced me, even though they didn't agree with me all the time. But I was Irish, I Catholic, and I drank a lot. And my dad said, you'll go far in that city.
I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah.
David is...
Jack,
yeah.
One of my favorite sports writers was Irish, Catholic, and drank a lot. Ray Fitzgerald in Boston.
That's right.
Talked about the green monster. Bill, in his book, The Wrong Stuff, talks about the green monster. The monster giveth and the monster taketh.
Yeah.
But Fitzgerald once had one of the great lines ever. He wrote kind of this fantasy column about the Reds playing the Red Sox. It was in the World Series. It's an interview with the green monster. The monster says, so who we got tomorrow? And Ray Fitz says, Billingham for the Reds. And the green monster says, yummy.
Boy, was he right.
Yeah.
Let's take a call from David. Hello.
Hey there. I had four quick points to make, but Bill Lee just eliminated one of them.
Okay.
I wanted to hear that story again about driving around and ending up in Cambridge, which he's told so many times, and I can relate because I'm from out of town.
Okay.
In fact, I'm from New York, and I grew up when the Mets won the World Series, and then a few years later with Tug McGraw and You Gotta Believe and all that. And I really loved baseball back then. It was just an amazing sport to me, and I can definitely relate to the previous caller who said, you know, we used to go out in the fields and pretend that we were these players because we had a connection with them, and they were around for a long enough time for us to form that connection.
Mm-hmm.
And now I see that, you know, it's up to us us fathers out there, because I'm a father now and I have an 11-year-old boy, to kind of instill that passion in our children. And I just think that today, especially in today's economic climate where everybody's doing more with less and both parents are working, it's become even more difficult. I mean, it's just been it's been an impossible dream to stay involved in Little League ball and to be there every day for the coaching and get our kids really psyched about the sport. But we do it anyway.
Yeah.
We do it because we have that dream. We have that dream that we can keep the passion alive. We do it because we know we can get 12 kids on the ball field, and at the end of the day, they can walk off and say, God, that was a lot of fun. We had a great time. And we hope we can pass that on. And the reason I do it, the main reason I do it is because my father did it, you know, and I remember I look back on that and he created a memory for me, and I hope to create that memory for my kids, and I hope that other parents out there are doing it too, but I can respect how difficult it is these days.
Yeah, what about that, Dave Kindred, the sort of basis of the game among young men? I mean, it's still played. Everybody has Little League, but I've read statistics that it isn't what it used to be.
Well, you talked earlier about whether baseball is still the national pastime. I think it is. In an emotional sense, as your caller there suggests, it touches our hearts in ways that football certainly can't. I mean, George Will defined football best I think, where he said it reflected American, the worst of American society, committee meetings followed by violence. You know, we go out in the front yard to play the diving game, or we go out in the front yard to play catch with our sons or daughters. No one goes in the front yard to practice chop blocks.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, I
think there is, you know, and I just don't buy the idea that no one cares about baseball anymore. I think there's a different feel for it, but it's such a natural game, and it's the best game. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the end, anyone who plays the game and understands the game mm-hmm. understands what Red Smith was talking about when he said it's a dull game only for those with dull minds.
Yeah.
If you pay attention, if your attention span is at least like 25 seconds, baseball is the best game that there ever will be.
Yeah, David, your response?
Well, you know, referring to the attention span, we were just having this discussion the other day. You know, it is hard for us to go to the ballpark these days. A, it's way too expensive for a day at the ballpark.
Yeah, what is it, $100 for a couple?
It's
three kids?
It's ridiculously expensive to go there, get some food, sit there. But one of the things I look forward to in terms of spending time watching baseball is when I get old and gray and I go down and I live in Sarasota and I go watch spring training and I sit there out in the stands just soaking up the rays, watching these guys just get their, you know, get warmed up for the season. To me, that is an opportunity to almost bring it down to the human level that we were describing earlier with the minor leagues.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, David. Bill Lee, a friend of mine who coaches baseball, and I coach some baseball, Little League, told me, he says, you know, baseball is, you got to teach the kids, it's about managing failure. That, you know, if you do it three times in 10, you're in the Hall of Fame. No other sport has an unforgiving sort of metric like that.
Keep your head up.
Keep your head up.
Don't let your, you know, don't get down on yourself.
Yeah.
I'll get down on you. No, that's Tim Foley's dad. That's an inside joke. Foley played for my dad and me in Little League and stuff, and every time he'd have a bad game, his dad would give him a hard time, and boy, he was a tough kid. He was a great ball player, but he had a little kind of a rough time in the pros.
Yeah, but is there a character dimension to this that you got to learn to manage failure, and we have to learn to do that in life, too?
Yeah, it's baseball. I mean, you go 0 for 4, and the other day, I forget who it was, he hit for the cycle back, the little second baseman for Houston. And
Biggio.
Yeah, Biggio, and then the next 4 days, he goes 0 for 15, you know? So don't get too high.
Yeah,
that's what we teach kids. Don't get too excited. Don't get too full of yourself, because the game is a very humbling game, and it will definitely bring you down. And once you start hitting home runs, you'll start trying to jerk everything out, and all of a sudden, next thing you know, you'll be in a slump.
That's one of the great things about baseball. I think that the general public doesn't quite grasp, certainly the football fan doesn't grasp how difficult baseball is. Because Major League baseball players are at such a level. It's you know, I was a college baseball player, Division II, and I couldn't carry anybody's glove.
Yeah.
I mean, those guys are so good and make difficult plays look so easy.
I know.
And the pitchers know what they're doing, except for Lee, of course. He just kind of threw it up there. He talked to the ball.
Yeah, that was Fidrich.
That was Fidrich.
He didn't talk
silently.
He didn't answer.
He communed with the ball.
Yeah. No.
That's what they did at USC. We'll be right back. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
Robinson waits. Here comes the pitch. And there goes a line drive to left field. Swan is after it. He leaps. It's over his head against the wall. Here comes Gillian scoring. Brooklyn wins. Jackie Robinson is being pummeled by his teammates.
That was Jackie Robinson's game-winning hit for the Dodgers against the Yankees in Game 6 of the 1956 World Series. Bob Wolf had the call. We're talking baseball this hour at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest is Dave Kindred, columnist for the Sporting News and an author of a recent book, just published book, Club Stories, The Collected Baseball Writings of Dave Kindred, and Bill Lee, the former Red Sox pitcher. Bill Lee, I'm looking at a piece in Sports Illustrated that says Jason Giambi has added 30 pounds to 235 pounds. Barry Bonds has put on 43 pounds since he came into the major league. And I see here that Edgar Martinez is 5'11" and weighs 210 pounds. I'm about 5'11", and I weigh 145. What has happened to the baseball body? And isn't this kind of an arms race against pitchers? Pitchers can only get so big, but these guys look like mastodons.
Yeah, it's ADM, Arthur Daniels, Midland, all the other companies that put out stuff. There's so much steroids in your chicken now. It used to take a Purdue chicken, I think it was like 9 weeks to mature. Now it can mature in 6¾. It's all of our food, everything. You look at every kid, you look at obesity in our society, and these guys are big. They lift now, and they take supplements. And you look at McGuire, his boy, he just pounded the ball. Bonds has got hamstring problems. Martinez has got hamstring problems. Giambi's got hamstring problems. They all, you just can't carry that weight over a course of a season. And good for Giambi, because I hate the Yankees, you know. But what the heck, Manny Ramirez, he pulled a hamstring in the middle of last year. Yeah. He never came back the way he was. It keeps aggravating it, and the Red Sox fell from favor. So
yeah.
It's our diet, and it's a shame.
Yeah, you know, Dave Kindred, your hero, Stan the Man, he was whippet lean.
In fact, I asked him during the McGuire chase. I talked to Musial, did a column what he thought about McGuire's chase of 70. And it was interesting. First of all, he said that it used to be a New York thing, that the 60 and 61 never really mattered around baseball because it was a New York thing and people ignored it.
Mm-hmm.
But McGuire brought it to the heartland, so everyone was all wrapped up in that. But he said that I asked him if he had taken any supplements, knowing he hadn't. You know, in the 40s when he was like 6'1", 180, and he said, I'd have a steak once in a while and a highball. So they used to call me a low ball hitter and a highball drinker. And that was about it in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
You know, but nowadays, I mean, I'm much more conversant with steroids and football because, you know, naked use there.
Yeah.
And to see, you know, they're, with the bodies break down, as Bill talked about. They're just, the skeleton is not made to carry
that
much
weight
and that much torque, especially in baseball.
Yeah, Frank Thomas, 275 pounds. Stan is on the line. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to go back a little bit to what you were talking about addressing earlier, and that's the expansion or the cutback of the teams and that sort of thing. And my love for baseball goes way, way back. The highlight of my life, people talk about memories in their life.
Yep.
They'll never forget. Highlight of my life was Bill Mazeroski hitting that,
oh, gosh,
that
yes.
home run in 1960.
Oh, yes, I remember it. And you know, they still have the plate preserved in Pittsburgh. The stadium is gone and everything else. You walk up to the sidewalk, and there's this plate. Still there.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. I have been writing for years to the Hall of Fame to get Bill Mazeroski into the Hall of Fame because I always thought that defensive guys weren't given enough credit. And I'm glad to see Ozzie Smith is going to probably get in. And,
yeah.
You know, finally getting some reward.
Yeah.
But, I'm glad to see that part of the game getting recognized a little bit. But my comment is that when I was a boy, of course, in the 50s, there were only 16 teams.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just nostalgia, but, boy, I knew everybody, every player, and every one of those teams. And they didn't get traded around so much, and they didn't have the free agency. Mm-hmm. And you developed the loyalty, and you could know them all. Now, I don't remember how many teams there are, and I can't even remember what city they're all from half the time, much less remember all the players.
And heck, some of them are from Canada. We've got to move along, but thanks
okay.
so much, Dan. Thank you. Claudia is on the line. Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can, loud and clear.
Hi, I'm calling because I just want you to know that I still think that baseball is the greatest game there is. I was a kid in the 60s, and my first game was at Yankee Stadium with the Tigers, and I saw Mickey Mantle play, and there was a triple play. And
oh,
I still get that same rush I did then. And with all due respect, you guys, and I love you, Bill Lee, but I think that you sound like my grandparents. Things aren't what they used to be, and it was better in the old days. Well, I think it's still the greatest game. And, you know, I think baseball has gotten better. And in spite of the owners' efforts to destroy it, they haven't destroyed it. The business of baseball stinks.
Yeah.
And if you ignore it and you just really, really enjoy the game, it's still good. You know, we didn't have six-foot shortstops when I was a kid who jumped like gazelles. And, you know, I can't stay on too long because Pedro's pitching tonight and I got to go. But,
go ahead.
I saw the Yankee Red Sox game last Saturday. Shea Hillenbrand hit a 2-run homer in the eighth.
Boy.
It was just such a great game, and it's still good.
Yeah,
and
I think
baseball players have gotten better.
Right, and it's a civic event, a thing like that. Everybody gets drawn in. Thanks so much. Bill Lee, are you getting to be an old codger? It was better in the old days?
Well, I'll tell you something. If they want to contract the ball club, they should contract the New York Yankees. That'll solve all the problems.
I think you're kind of monomaniacal on the subject of the pinstripes.
No, they're the problem.
They're the problem.
They're the problem. They don't want to share. They don't want to do anything.
Right.
They get all the other owners out there.
Right.
They think they can make more money and everything else.
Yep.
They don't realize that you have to have competition in order to have a league.
Yeah.
And as far as downsizing a town, Montreal, we drew $2.7 million for 3 years in a row.
Mm.
We were a great organization, and then they put a roof over it. They domed it in, and people in Canada don't want to be domed. You watch Toronto. No one goes to Toronto games. That's done. Minnesota, Dome Stadium. No one goes there anymore.
Mm.
You got to play outdoors.
Yeah,
it's about
being outdoors.
Has his park, right? Does he have his park?
Oh, boy.
Now you all have to go get yours. And I'll tell you, another guy was a guy, the president of the United States.
Yeah.
He pushed a bill through Arlington to have them pay for the thing. They gave him another about 2 points or 4.7%, and then he ended up selling out, and he made like $5 million more than he had, or actually $14.9 million.
Nice work if you can get it.
Republicans steal a lot. Democrats just steal a little.
Let's get Steve on the line. Hi, Steve. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually sitting here in the Sumner Tunnel, so this is just wonderful.
Oh, great.
Working in there?
No. This is a sort of awful day at the airport where I turned around
and
couldn't get on the phone.
Out.
Right. Can you hear me now? Okay. So my comment is, I grew up in Kansas City. I live in Boston now, and you know, I'm sort of hearing this mixture of nostalgia and sadness in your conversation, and it really, really struck a chord for me. I'm 36. When I was a kid, it was always the Yankees, and the Yankees always beat the poop out of the Royals. But it was always the Yankees and the Royals in the playoffs. And I was thinking, I'm a big football fan, and you were sort of having to go at football and saying, what's the difference? The difference for me is that baseball has a million stories connected to it, and that's what generates my nostalgia, is the stories. And one of the stories that came to mind was Satchel Paige was a patient of my dad's, who was a lung doctor.
Yeah.
And my dad brought me a ball home that Satchel Paige had signed when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And I didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
I was like, so? And my dad took the ball back. He said, you go find out who he is. And when you're kind of old enough to know who he is and appreciate that,
I love that.
You can have the ball.
I love that. That's great. Hey, thanks. And don't breathe the air in that tunnel. Bill Lee, do you have any memento like that, a signed baseball from somebody?
Wow, I would love that. Satchel Paige is my idol. I believe I'm the white Satchel Paige. I play everywhere,
How about you, Dave Kindred? Have you got a memento?
Pee-wee Reese jersey is mine.
That's something to have. Hey, listen, you guys, thanks so much. It's just been great having you on.
Thank you, Jack. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Bill. We've talked to Bill Lee, the former Red Sox pitcher, and Dave Kindred, columnist for the Sporting News, author of Glove Stories, the collected baseball writings of Dave Kindred. To read the first chapter of Glove Stories, check out our website. The address is onpointradio.org.
Thank you.
Baseball may be known as the American pastime, but according to Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, the lure and magic of baseball belongs to all nations and all people.
Who knows where it came from? The English claim that baseball as we know it is descended from a game called rounders, the essentials of which are evident in cricket as well as baseball. Lots of other cultures have their own versions of baseball's beginning. Perhaps the weirdest comes from Russia. Back in the days when the Soviet Union was a union, Izvestia ran an article alleging that baseball was the descendant of a game called lapta, which was popular on the steppes when Ivan the Terrible reigned. Our own grand lie is that baseball sprang full-blown from the mind and heart of Abner Doubleday, a fable so transparently fraudulent that not even the historians who work in the National Baseball Library can recite it without smirking. But no matter. Cooperstown, the bucolic home of the Hall of Fame, Doubleday Field, and a company that still makes wooden bats would have required inventing if it hadn't already been there. For a game that probably began the first time an ape who was neither hungry nor cold tossed a rock into the air and whacked it with a stick just to see if he could do it, Cooperstown is as good a mythical birthplace as any and better than most. However and wherever it began, baseball has continued to toss off and carry like satellites a variety of other formal and informal games. Some, like the brand of stickball played in the streets of New York over the years, have cultures all their own. On some Manhattan blocks, tales are perhaps still told of how many sewers Willie Mays, who used to play with the kids before or after games at the polo grounds, could hit a Spalding. Stickball requires no field, of course, only a street, a rubber ball, and a broomstick. Chipitas, the stripped-down Latin American version of stickball, does without not only the field and the regulation bat, but the ball as well. Kids fish in storm drains and garbage cans for bottle caps and take turns flipping them toward the hitter. To youngsters who graduate from the Chipitas leagues to an honest baseball field, the ball must look about 8 feet across and still as a pie on a windowsill. Maybe it's a good place to start. Roberto Clemente's ball playing began in the Chipitas leagues, though the first scout to recruit him for organized baseball did so on the basis of how far the youngster could hit an empty tomato can with a tree branch.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd.
In 1954, the same year in which Willie Mays made the catch, historian Jacques Barzun offered this often repeated observation: whoever wants to know the heart and mind of America had better learn baseball, the rules, and the realities of the game, and do it by watching first some high school or small town teams. It is perhaps time to update this observation. Whoever wants to know the heart and mind and pain and triumph and ingenuity of the human animal had better check out not only baseball, wherever it turns up, and softball, whether anybody's watching or not, but also stickball, chipitas, one-a-cat, wiffle ball, running bases, stoop ball, the gay leagues, the old guy leagues, the blind leagues, and the various games of the imagination that a child can play when a rubber ball comes back at him as a grounder or a fly off the garage door or the back steps. It's a mean fact that some children have nothing but bottle caps and balls of rolled-up paper to throw at one another, a fact that should engender in us shame and the determination to make a better world. But we can also smile at the games children make of nearly nothing. We can see hope in that capacity, and we can celebrate as we consider all the manifestations of baseball, the undeniable spirit of affirmation present in the desire and the determination of so many to play merely for the joy that our best game offers.
For it's one, two, three cycled out at the old ball again.
That was Bill Littlefield reading from his book, Baseball Days. Littlefield is the host of NPR's Only a Game. His most recent book is The Circus in the Woods. You can read other commentaries by Bill Littlefield by visiting onlyagame.org. I'm Jack Beattie. This is On Point.